Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Whiskey Congress is back in session with a bonus episode again. Steve's got us all hooked up on Zoom again. So, Steve, how you doing, buddy?
Good, how are you?
Doing well. And with us once again is our buddy Ben at Existential, EXIS10IAL from Twitter, who is our market expert. And the markets have been a bit weird. Steve, you want to lead with what's been going on?
Well, I mean, I think the big focus for today is, you know, what happened with oil yesterday. Oil had been a bit, and it finally bottomed out yesterday in the markets. We saw the cost per barrel, you know, essentially go down to zero in kind of the, I don't know, in an existential sort of way, I guess. That's not the actual price of a barrel of oil, but Ben, you want to take us through kind of what happened and, you know, what this means for energy, what it means for oil, because, you know, on our last show, you said that you felt that this was a good place, a possible place where people should look. Obviously, it bottomed out. So kind of take us through what happened and then, you know, where things are going and then where people can find those negative $37 stocks for oil.
Sure. Happy to walk through it a bit with you guys. By the way, thanks for having me on again. It's always cool to connect with you guys, especially now that we're all in quarantine. So it's nice to have some human interaction. So with regard to oil, there's a huge misconception of what happened yesterday. I saw a lot of activity on social media, for example, you know, people talking about, you know, oil being free or, you know, negative prices on oil. And I'm not sure people understand commodity trading versus equity trading in this case. Essentially, what happened yesterday was that the May futures contract on oil, and the way futures work is you buy one contract, it means that you're obligated to buy 1,000 barrels of oil at a certain price. And that futures contract is essentially an amalgam of three prices. One is the spot price, which is the global market price. Then there's the cash price, which is essentially the physical market, what it's actually transacting for out in the trade. Then there's the futures market, which is highly speculative and mostly paper traders, meaning these are traders out there that are speculative traders. They have zero intention of taking delivery on oil. And when these traders get squeezed on a long position in an oil futures contract, or in this case, tens of thousands of them, they get to a point where they kind of pressed their luck and waited, hoping for a geopolitical event or maybe an OPEC production cut or some kind of a deal with Trump and Mexico and some of the other oil producing countries like Iran, and no deal materialized. So the price of oil continued to plummet, and you've had the shock, obviously, with COVID, both on the supply side, meaning that we've continued to pump oil as we would otherwise. And then of course the shock on the demand side, nobody's driving around, economies are shut down. So consumption of oil has plummeted. So all of those confluence of factors created a situation where futures prices, not spot oil or even cash oil, even though cash oil is severely depressed as well, but it created a situation where futures contracts actually went negative because these paper traders, they did the math and said, well, I either got to exercise my contract and pay all this money to have it shipped from Oklahoma, which is where the oil sits on these futures contract, have it barreled up and shipped over to me, and then I got to pay for storage on that. So you know what? I'd rather sell the contracts. It closed at what, negative $35 or something yesterday. And if you watch the markets this morning, it opened this morning about like $3.50. So it bounced back into positive territory, but the June contracts are now coming down. And so that's kind of what happened. And that's, there's a factor in the futures markets called contango. And I would actually encourage your listeners to just Google contango and understand what that means. It's not a dance. It sounds like a dance.
Spell it, please.
Yeah. It's actually a phenomenon where futures prices tend to converge with the actual spot price as you reach expiration on a contract. And that sounds complicated, but it's actually not. But what we had here was called backwardation, which means the futures price was actually below the price of the commodity. That's called backwardation as opposed to forwardation. Forwardation is when the futures price is actually above the commodity price. All of that convergence is called contango, and that would be something that might be useful for your listeners to just familiarize themselves with. Although I would encourage them not to trade commodities if you are not a very advanced trader, a very sophisticated trader. This is not for the faint of heart. There's very high risk involved, as was illustrated by the price movement yesterday. So, but it's something to just familiarize yourselves with so you understand the dynamics of oil.
So how is Cantango spelled, just so people know how to look it up? Is it C-A-N-T-A-N-G-O?
O-N-T-A-N. Yeah, Contango.
Okay. Contango, okay, thank you.
So with what happened yesterday and what you're talking about now, we're not going to – things aren't going to change where we're going to – where people are going to start driving anytime soon. Although we have seen some states start to kind of pull back their stay-at-home orders, and some businesses are opening up, whether it's, you know, Georgia or Florida or Texas. So we'll see some movement, but there still hasn't been, you know, that sort of geopolitical event that says, you know, the demand for oil is going to spike. So what do these traders do now? And kind of what do you expect to see with the oil market?
The June futures contracts saw a lot of pressure today as well. So my expectation, to your point, Steve, I don't see a lot of changes in terms of dynamics of demand. The changes have to come on the supply side with regard to production, so pulling the stuff out of the ground. The other element is storage. And so one of the ways that this kind of imbalance has been mitigated is through, creative ways to store oil. And a lot of that's being done offshore on tanker ships. So you're seeing, you know, some of these tanker ship equities start to see some growth. And, that's been an interesting dynamic to watch. So we need to see that imbalance kind of shift out. And that could take, again, I always hate to put firm timelines on what I think is going to happen in markets because that's kind of a fool's errand. But I would say 30 to 45 days before we see a stabilization. I certainly wouldn't be buying June expiration WTI contracts right now. I think that might be a little too risky.
Right.
Now, to your point too, though, Steve, and because you had asked me earlier, actually before we got on air, about, you know, how do you invest in oil to try to take advantage of these, depressed prices. There's not a lot of great ways to do it, because if you looked at refiners and some of the legacy oil companies like Chevron, Exxon, BP, et cetera, they've actually been fairly resilient through this. They're not as exposed to some of these massive price fluctuations. I flubbed that a little bit. So it's very difficult to take advantage of these prices in terms of investment. I mean, in fact, and I had put the tweet out yesterday, there's an ETF in the US called USO is the ticker. And it's essentially an ETF that captures these futures contracts. And it's a rolling ETF. So their exposure is disproportional to the front month in these futures contracts. And, kind of rookie investors that are thinking like, I'm going to buy oil, I need to buy oil, and they poured into this USO ETF thinking that they were buying spot oil, which is just hilariously misguided. And these people are going to get their dick ripped off, man. There's like no doubt about it.
Right.
It's not an area where you really want to play. Now, I've talked to you guys in the past, and if people listen to our previous conversations, I still like energy. I think energy is great. I think it's a great contrarian play. And in fact, even some of the energy names that I own have done really well through this, but you really have to be a little bit more of a sophisticated investor to navigate a strategy that's going to make you money under these circumstances, because it's not as simple as people want to think it is. Because, you know, again, oil, spot oil is still around $23 to $25 a barrel, okay, in the global market. So it's not free. It's not negative. Those are futures contracts, and that's a totally, totally different, you know, market dynamic.
And Ben, if I'm wrong here, please correct me, but I do a little bit with options trading, but I only do puts and calls. So there's a cap on how much I can lose. With these kinds of equity trading.
On calls there is, yeah. Not necessarily on puts.
Well, I buy a contract and I can just let expire and not exercise it.
Right. I mean, so you're naked puts, or are you covered? Is it a credit spread?
Yeah. I don't know.
Anyway,
my question was, we can do that another time. My question is, my statement is, and I can correct me if I'm wrong, with this kind of options trading, futures trading, there is no cap on how much you can lose. So you can become incredibly exposed, hence leading to the situation you just described. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, it's just accurate in that people don't understand, you know, your point, Tim, when you're talking about options trading. I mean, let's say you bust out on a position, and to your point, let's say you bought some calls that wind up out of the money and they expire worthless. You know, no big deal. You lost the money. You're done, right?
Oh, I've done it.
Yeah, it sounds like you know that process. So, and believe me, I know that process too. Don't get me wrong. But yeah, with commodities, it's a different animal, because you're committed to taking delivery on whatever you buy. You could be buying coffee. You could be buying heads of cattle. Think about it. One contract for livestock is 50,000 pounds of livestock. One contract on corn is 5,000 bushels of corn. Coffee is like 10,000 pounds of coffee. I mean,
what about frozen concentrated orange juice? So they understand that's a hot commodity.
Whatever the
commodity. A trading places joke. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist.
Yeah, it requires physical delivery if you're going to play in that space. So you just have to understand that it's a paper trade. And, you know, if you do get squeezed and you're in a bad spot, you could lose more than you put in, for sure.
Hence the reason for contracts going negative. Again, I partially wanted clarification about risk, and I wanted to make the trading places joke because I cannot help myself.
Yeah, no, and it's a good joke, and it's relevant. And but yeah, so I mean, options trading is different. It's still very risky. Options trading, again, is a little bit more sophisticated than just simply going long or short equities. And going short is a little more sophisticated as well. But most retail investors are just looking to keep a net long book, is what I'd call that. Meaning they're just buying stocks, hoping those stocks go higher. There's nothing wrong with that strategy. It's a fine strategy. As you get more comfortable and more sophisticated, there's ways you can hedge that strategy. That's largely what I do. But I do play in Forex markets, for example, which means international currencies. And I do play in the options and futures markets, but not in oil, because oil is just there's a lot of very sophisticated traders, you know, playing in oil. And, you know, so to your point, Steve, you know, when some folks are like, how do I trade oil? It's like, would you challenge LeBron to a game of one-on-one and say, you know, if I win, I get $1,000, and if you win, I get 10, you know, it's probably a bad bet, you know, right? And you're going up against some of the most sophisticated traders in the world. And if you think as a person that's just wandering into this shit, like, you're going to not get crushed, have at it. Let me know how it goes.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's funny because it was a family member that had approached me about it, and I was busy at the time, so I didn't reply with my first instinct was, what the fuck is wrong with you? No. But I was able to kind of push her off in hopes for a conversation later. You know, and what's interesting about, I guess, what's happening right now is that, you know, because people have more time, I think there is an uptick in people paying attention to the markets and talking about access, whether it's Webull or Robinhood. When you mix time with access, I think there's an uptick in people trying to actually dip their toe in the water of retail trading. Which is a good thing, right? Especially people who wouldn't normally feel that they have access to it, because, you know, brokerage firms are really expensive and they don't, you know, it's like, who's their money guy? Who's their investment guy? But now all of a sudden there are ways where you can do it yourself. But I think what you're saying, especially as it relates to oil, which should probably really be a larger umbrella, is that, you know, all of this is really complicated stuff, and you need to go into it with an understanding. Like, you can't just wake up one morning and say, all right, I'm going to start investing and I'm going to start trading. Let me open an account and, oh, oil is down, so I'm going to buy low. And then when it gets, you know, when the price goes back up, I'm going to sell high. I mean, that's, you know, we talked about that in the past, and that just seems to be the recurring theme that you see, whether it's on social media or people that you talk to. And it's a little bit scary just because of what people are putting out there, what they could lose. You know, we do know that the average family, you know, isn't prepared for a $400 or $500 emergency. You know, so now those same people are saying, all right, let me drop a couple $100 into Robinhood or Webull or whatever it might be. And, you know, they put their money into something and boom, it's gone. And it's just like, all right, you can't just go into this thinking that, you know, oh, if Ben can do it, I can do it. You know, how many years have you been, you know, studying this and trial and error, you know, to get to it? And that's the part that people don't understand.
Yeah. And to your point, I think it is great that people are more interested in the markets, and certainly to your point with like sports being canceled, for example, I've certainly noticed an uptick in interest. And a lot more interaction just from my end on people that are interested in strategies and how to put on trades. And I think that's great because it is a trial and error process. I think I've shared this with you guys in the past. I mean, the only way I got good at this was losing a fucking lot of money, a lot of money. I was not good at this when I started. I thought I was good at it. I thought I was the smartest guy in the room. Turns out I'm not. And, you know, that's how you get good at it, because you feel the pain of losing money. And, you know, people tie a lot of emotion to money. And sometimes it's, to your point, Steve, sometimes it's a practical matter where it's like, hey, I got to pay my mortgage and put food on the table. And other times it's just greed and fear and how that plays into your psychology. So a big part of getting proficient with trading is learning how to control your emotions. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges. And like I've said to you guys before, if you're a market watcher and you're somewhat familiar with, you know, what's happening from a trend standpoint, you pretty much instinctively know what's a good stock to buy or a good company to invest in. The difficult part is knowing when to sell it. If you're going to tactically trade, that's a difficult thing to master. It takes time. It takes understanding the cadence of the market and getting to know the market. And we talked at length about this in our conversation, I think two or three conversations ago. So that's just something to think about as people kind of dip their toe in the water, but I encourage them to do that. But yeah, manage your risk and you'll learn pretty quick. And a lot of times, unfortunately, it takes losing money to learn that lesson.
And Ben, I guess, so another question would be where would you send people to start to learn? Obviously experience is a great teacher, but before people open an account with a brokerage, where would you kind of point them to say, you know, go get the basics of what you're doing before you even put a dollar down? And also, is there a place where people can maybe practice trades and do like a dry run before they jump all the way in?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, there are definitely platforms that will allow you to essentially play trade and just create kind of a virtual portfolio and just see how it would perform. That's a great way to just do some dry runs. I'm hesitant to say follow me on Twitter because that's one good way to learn something. I'm putting out a lot of stuff from, you know, but I don't, I get a lot of questions from people, then they expect that I'm going to hold their hand through every trade they make because I'm posting a lot of research and things like that. So following me on Twitter is a good way to just get access to research that you might not be able to find on the internet otherwise. But one of the easiest ways, honestly, Steve, is just immerse yourself in financial media. Watch Bloomberg, watch CNBC. If Fox Business is your flavor of choice, watch Fox Business. Get immersed in it, understand the language. You and I, you guys, we've all joked about all the acronyms that sometimes I use in some of the vernacular of the markets. It can sound confusing and intimidating, but once you get your arms around that aspect of it, you get a better sense of, you know, just how to navigate the space. And then you get more advanced as things go along and you start to put on more sophisticated trade strategies. And that's the best way to learn. And it takes time, just like learning how to play the piano or becoming a great basketball player. Or, you know, yeah, or a power lifter, or what'd you say? What was that?
A great guitarist.
Yeah,
or a great stand-up comedian.
Or a great stand-up comedian. I mean, Jim, how did you get good at stand-up? I mean, you
Steve,
had to.
Right, first of all, Steve, shut your mouth.
You're a funny guy.
Jim is going to get back to you on that.
funny, see, you're. But honestly, God, the other day something popped up and it was a set of mine from 5 years ago. It popped up on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I watched myself 5 years ago and I had the option to share and I chose not to because golly. And the difference between comedy and investing is in comedy, you can delude yourself into thinking you're doing better than you are. In investing, the money tells you there's a distinct measure. I mean, my set, I had like 5 or 6 friends there. So people were laughing because they were supporting me. But I'm looking at it going, dude, why did you keep doing this shit? Investing, there's a very cold, hard measurement that tells you you're either doing this well or you're not. And actually, the one thing I would say is when I started playing poker, which I was very serious about for a while, I thought I was good at it. And then the facts told me, no, you're good at getting up in tournaments, but you're not good at staying in tournaments. And when I learned that lesson and learned why, I became a much better tournament poker player. And the money backed it up.
Yeah. No, I think that's a fair example. Because there, you know, not unlike poker, I mean, there's obviously risk involved with the markets. It's just, you know, it's a little bit, and not to knock poker at all. I don't mean to say it that way, but you know, it's the financial markets are just the most sophisticated game in the whole world, and you're up against the most sophisticated traders in the whole world. So you really have to just nibble and get comfortable and get more advanced, and just really, again, learn how to manage your emotions, because I think that's probably the biggest challenge psychologically is just, you know, not avoiding submitting to your greed. You know, when you got a position that's running, you got to trim it. You got to have the discipline to trim, and you got to have the discipline to cut a trade loose when you were wrong. It's hard to say sometimes you're wrong. You know, I mean, look at, you know, politicians, a lot of times they struggle to admit that they were wrong. You got to do it in the markets, or else, you know, it costs you money.
I have a personal story about that, actually. A guy who knows stocks really well talked to me about a stock that was went crazy after its IPO. I bought a short position on it and immediately made a bunch of money, but my greed stopped.
The Beyond Meat trade? The one
I don't know how you saw through me so easily, Ben.
Jim, I got a mind like a goddamn steel trap, my man. So.
Yes, and I wouldn't. You actually said to me, "Take the money and run." My ego didn't let me do it. Fast forward a month, and my gains were gone.
Well, it's funny. I was actually talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and it's a younger kid. He's in his mid-20s. He's just getting in his feet wet in investing, and he and I work together at a whiskey company. So we've known each other a long time, and he knows that I I'm active in the market. And I had given him a name. And you know what? I'll even throw the name out there. Why not? One Life Medical, ONEM is the ticker. And I had told him about this ticker about 3 or 4 months ago. I said, you know, look, I'm taking a long position. I'm not telling you what to do, but here's why I like it. I gave him my thesis and said, look, you're a young trader. Maybe it's a good way for you to manage a position and just figure out what to do. Well, the stock ripped about 20% yesterday, and it was up about 20% yesterday. Let's call it around 11:30 a.m. or noon. And I texted him. I said, where are you at on One Life? And he's like, well, he's like excited. He's like, I can't believe, thank you so much. It's such a great, you know, position. I've made all this money. I said, you need to sell it right now. And he's like, what are you talking about? This thing's things going to the moon. I mean, you know, maybe I'm going to retire off this year. Well, he didn't say that, but he was just very excited. I said, no, you got to sell the position. And he refused to do that. He said, well, you know, I'm going to ride it out. And I said, okay, but just mark the text. Just remember, I advise you other. Well, today it was down a little over 10%, you know, and finding that's part of learning the market. You got to start to get a sense of the cadence of it. There's a very distinct cadence, and it's not, you know, this is an example of a spec stock that's a low market cap, high volatility, not a lot of volume. These prices move around like crazy. So when you see a 20% up day, you don't have to sell your whole position, but you got to sell something on a day like that. And you know, he couldn't do it. So he wound up, you know, he wound up getting hurt a little bit today. And he actually texted me this afternoon and said, well, you were right. And next time I'm going to listen to Ben. So,
I mean, and you know, it's funny. I can definitely understand that. You know, and I'm a little bit of a fraidy cat, you know, when it comes to investing, if that makes sense. And that if I see something starting to really spike and rip, then I'm immediately afraid that, like, all right, if I don't do something, then this is going to go back the other direction. I'm going to be pissed at myself that I didn't do it. And because I've watched it, you know, I've watched long enough to see that very few things just continue to rise up, you know, like an Amazon or an Apple or things like that. So these smaller stocks that are, you know, at the lower end of the spectrum that are being traded, like if you see something really go up and it's a lot, then maybe you have to let go of that ego a little bit. And I guess mine is just more out of paranoia on missing kind of the peak and then being stuck with something that, you know, really never sees that again, whatever caused that bump.
Yeah. I mean, Steve, that's a really practical way of approaching it. And I think that's a disciplined way of approaching it. And I applaud that, because not a lot of folks, they develop a confirmation bias. You know, when you take a position in a stock, particularly a substantial position, and it starts to move in the right direction, you develop a confirmation bias where you're like, oh my gosh, I was right. And you know how people are once they're convinced that they're right, it gets really hard to convince them that they might be wrong, you know, that it's going to continue to move in the same direction. So that is a tough psychological point.
And I guess part of that too is, you know, you have to look, and I could be wrong, but I feel like you have to look at a stock and figure out what's its potential. You know, you look at the sector, you look at, you know, like similar companies, similar stocks, and then you figure out, okay, this is, you know, you look at the best of the best in that sector, right? You say, does this stock have the potential to kind of meet that same potential? And if it's just like, there's not enough information to really tell you that, then my thought is, with all the data that you have, you say, all right, chances are the best that you're going to see with this thing is maybe, you know, a 20% increase, you know, and maybe you mark that down, you know, whenever, like, because every stock that I invest in, I try to put together some form of a plan, right? And part of that plan is kind of like its max potential, and then how far it could go down. And then at what point do I say, all right, if it gets to here, then you have to sell it. And the one part that I guess I don't employ is, you know, holding on to a part of the position to see where that goes, right? So maybe that's something that I need to start to kind of work into it. But, you know, usually it's kind of predetermined that if I see something that gets to a point where I've already said, all right, I think that this is the max that it can get. And that's not based off of years and years of investing experience. That's just based off of, again, me kind of being afraid of falling out. Then that's when it gets to that point, or it gets anywhere close and I see a little bit of a dip, then, you know, I'm out.
Listen, Steve, when you're done in the law space in, you know, real estate, let's come work. Right? You come work with me. Let's trade the market, because you got the right mind frame. That's exactly how you should look at it. That's why analysts put out what are called price targets. And those price targets are, hey, I think stock's going to go here within a certain time frame. When it does get here, we're going to reposition ourselves and reevaluate. That's exactly how you should trade. And it, you know, the oil thing, our conversation earlier, just reminds me of such a key lesson. And I had posted this maybe yesterday or a few days ago, but this whole COVID thing has really kind of reinforced and really kind of validated this lesson that you don't invest in the present. You don't invest based on the circumstances that we're in right now. You invest based on where you think things are going to be in 12 months or 18 months or 24 months. That's the oil question, right? You're getting calls from your relatives saying, how do I invest in oil right now? Well, that's the wrong way to think about it. You ought to be thinking about where's oil going to be in 12 months or 18 months. You already missed the trade. I mean, you know, it's like somebody trying to call and say, hey, should I buy Amazon at 2250? What the fuck? Where were you at 1500? You know, I mean, it's, you got to be thinking about things in 12 to 18 month increments. So that's one thing. But yeah, I mean, I think it also dovetails into that other thing, Steve. I think you and I interacted on this earlier, which was this acceleration towards a digital economy. And that's the other big takeaway from COVID, what it's done to the analog and brick and mortar economy versus the new generation of economy that we need to expect on the other side of this, which is, you know, it's cashless, it's on demand, it's internet based, it's virtual. And it's omni-channel. It's, you know, brands are going to have to interact with people in a very different way than they have in the past. So in fact, I actually wrote it down earlier today, and it actually is the acronym of COVID. If I actually broke out the thesis, COVID, I really do believe that is an irreversible trajectory that we're on. Because consumer behavior is not going to revert back to, what we've experienced in the past. I think that, you know, for example, you know, grocery delivery as just an example, you know, Walmart and Amazon are out front on that. Telemedicine with Teladoc and Livongo and One Life Medical. Now you got online learning, distance learning, and things like that. And think about social distancing as it relates to movie theaters. I mean, movie theaters, how are they going to operate? You're going to have a 150-seat theater that's only a 75 or 50-seat theater now. Think about restaurants. You know, restaurant, 200-seat restaurant now is a 75-seat restaurant due to social distancing. How the hell are you going to have a bar? How's the bartender going to interact with people? Are they going to have the plexiglass up like they have at the grocery store right now? I mean, these are all questions we don't know the answers to, but we can kind of, you know, prognosticate and handicap those answers. And I think that's how you have to be thinking as an investor right now.
You know, Ben, I'm a little offended that you want to partner up with the guy who's smart and taking the money and run and not the guy who likened the investing game to poker. I can't imagine why that
is. Jim, you know what? Jim, honestly, you seem more like a really focused, like a numbers guy. I'd like you on the analyst.
I'm a numbers guy, but I'm I've definitely fallen into the trap of I'm going to ride this out. You know, the sky's the limit, and the sky is not the limit.
You know what, Jim? Be the best comedian you can be. You don't have to be an investor and comedian. I mean, you can't be everything. Hell, I wish I was a fucking astronaut. I'm not. I'm
an engineer who does comedy for the people who don't go looking for my HBO special or my Netflix special anytime soon.
Well, I'm happy with being a hedge fund guy, and that makes me happy, and I enjoy being immersed in it. And, you know, the whiskey business was a lot of fun too. And, you know, you just find what you're good at and you try to stick with it.
But but in a somewhat serious way to respond to what you just said, the world of comedy has been shaken up in a huge way because comics can't go to open mics anymore and work material. Comics can't go to showcases and work material. You know, comedy clubs are closed. I've got a friend who's a local comic, and she's putting on a show in the next night or two. I'd give it a plug if I had the information in front of me. She's trying to charge $10 a person to watch her do a show from her living room, and right, she's a phenomenal comic. Good for her. But you know, are people going to start consuming live comedy on a pay-per-view basis? I don't know. I mean, would I rather watch, you know, someone who is, again, admittedly funny, but in that time slot for money, when I can go on Netflix and watch the Dave Chappelle, you know, Netflix bit again? And it's, I mean, a lot of the folks in that who are in that world for money are very concerned about whether or not that industry is going to come back or how it's going to come back.
Yeah, that's a tectonic shift. And you know what, in a parallel way, there's a band that I really love out of Arizona, and that's one of the, and they're a gig band. They go out and hit the road. That's how they make their money. And they're doing internet shows. And you got to subscribe through their channel to watch the shows. So yeah, it's just another example of how this economy has shifted. And I truly believe a lot of this is going to linger and eventually accelerate further once further adoption takes place. Right now, the adoption is being forced on us, but eventually we're going to realize, like, hey, it's more economical, it's more efficient, it's more conducive to your own lifestyle. And that's a trend that I think will linger for a long time.
Go ahead, Steve.
I was just going to say, and I think what we'll see is, like, this time frame right now can kind of be the almost what you would consider an overcorrection, right? In terms of, you know, everyone just getting everything delivered, and we have to because we don't have a choice. And so I think as soon as, you know, restrictions are lifted and we can go back to whatever the new normal is, I think there will be kind of a rush for people to go to restaurants and people to go to bars and all that sort of stuff. But then once that tide kind of recedes, then people will kind of be like, you know what? It was really, really convenient to be able to order my groceries online. And all of a sudden, it doesn't seem like something that's really only accessible to the, you know, rich soccer mom out in the suburbs. But now all of a sudden, that's just more accessible to everybody. And people start to see that. And then because the mechanisms are already in place and logistically it's already in place, a lot of these places are going to start to promote it because from the businesses themselves, it saves them money. It cuts down on their overhead. And, you know, like they only have to make, you know, slight changes that allow them to do this, but still bring in the revenue. Well, so, I mean, I think you're right. Like exactly the way we go, you know, and if we have a vaccine and a treatment for COVID-19 in October, I think you'll see a massive rush for people to say, hey, America's back. But then I think, you know, after that holiday season, and even during the holiday season, you're going to see just an uptick in, you know, everything, so many things being able to be digital and stay digital.
Yeah, and I think that's all true. I think the other issue is that once we do start phasing in normalization, people are not going to like the experience necessarily. You know, are people going to like going to a restaurant that's like socially distanced? Probably not. It's not going to be the same experience that they're used to, and it's going to be a little bit foreign and alien and awkward and maybe not as enjoyable as they've been, you know, experienced it in the past. So that's going to further shape and reinforce those behaviors. So, you know, we're creatures of habit. And think about it this way too. I mean, a lot of these businesses, particularly in this, you know, kind of service industry, are just simply not going to survive. I mean, you're going to see a cascade of defaults that we talked about in our last conversation. You know, fortunately, this PPP supplemental bill, it looks like it's going to pass. And hopefully some of the smaller businesses get access to some of those funds. And hats off to Shake Shack, for example, that gave back the money that they had gotten initially from PPP. But yeah, you know, I really worry about some of these restaurants because, like, you know, the example I used earlier, a 200-seat restaurant that's now 75 seats, I mean, that's, you're going to knock out 60%, you know, of your revenue, essentially. You know, what's your landlord? I mean, are you going to be able to renegotiate with your landlord? What does that look like? And then there's another cascade effect, right? Think about, you know, a lot of folks have invested in REITs, you know, real estate investment trust. Those are going to get crushed. I mean, think about all the businesses that are like, you know what, we can just all work remote now. Like, why should we spend all this money, like exorbitant amounts of money on office space? Doesn't make any sense. I mean, so that industry, I think, is going to get crushed. I'm not short REITs, but I've certainly liquidated REITs out of my portfolio. So there's going to be a cascade of effects that we haven't necessarily gotten our minds around because we're still in the midst of it. And it all happened so quickly. I mean, even though I know we've been on quarantine, it feels like 5 years. It's been, what, 5 weeks or 6 weeks. But we're going to see some lingering effects and some just tectonic shifts in the way we behave as consumers that are going to last for in perpetuity, in my view.
All right, guys. Well, look, I'm glad we're all able to kind of get together. We saw some crazy things in the market. Ben, We always appreciate you coming on and talking the talk with us and letting us know who's getting their dick ripped off next.
We went 15 minutes before a dick ripped off reference came in. This is a record.
That's true.
Yeah, always got to make a dick reference when we talk about the market. It's just how we do it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, I just appreciate it. And I hope that our listeners find it helpful. You know, if they are investing or they're thinking about investing, that's why we try to bring value and we want to be objective, at least in some of the stuff that we bring. And I think you do a good job with that. And it's just a little bit different than what we normally talk about. So hopefully start to bring more people in and hopefully people start inundating you with more questions so that you can get annoyed on Twitter. we really appreciate it. Jim, any last words?
Thanks a lot, Ben. Folks, if you want to email or tweet us, it's you're at Whiskey Congress on social media, at Whiskey Congress on Twitter and Instagram. You can email me, Jim, at WhiskeyCongress.com, or Steve, you can give me email at Steve at WhiskeyCongress.com. Again, it's nice to talk about something that isn't all, I mean, COVID played a big role in the conversation, but it wasn't all COVID and Trump, which is good. Which is good.
Yeah, and listen, guys, I always enjoy joining you guys, and any insights I can provide the market, I'm always happy to do it. You guys know how much I love talking shop, and look forward to our next conversation, whatever that looks like. Who knows what the market's going to do? I feel like we've still got some tumult ahead of us, so I'm sure there's going to be some fun things to talk about here in the coming weeks.
I'm certain you're right.
Absolutely.
All right. Absolutely.
Thanks so much, guys. I appreciate it.
Later.
Yep.
Thanks. All right.